From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the October 2020 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, a historian for the future. GCHQ has a new historian. In podcast episode 98, we had the honour of being able to reveal his identity when we met him at the GCHQ centenary celebrations at the National Memorial Arboretum in November 2019. We promised then that we'd catch up with him again, and this month we're doing just that. Podcast producer Mark sat down with Dr. David Abritat, the recently avowed departmental historian at GCHQ, to find out what he's been up to.
I'm sat in the archive at Bletchley Park, which seems the most appropriate place to bring you an interview we're recording specially today. A socially distanced interview, shall we say, because sat opposite me, on the other side of the room in fact, is the new GCHQ historian, Dr. David Abritat. David, welcome to the podcast. Now, it's not the first time you've been on it, is it?
It isn't, Mark, but good morning, and it's a pleasure to be here as always.
Long-time listeners will remember that last November we were really privileged to be invited to the centenary celebrations for GCHQ at the National Arboretum. And GCHQ gave us the opportunity to introduce their new historian, David. So David was with us on that show, but we were kind of focusing on Tony Comer, the previous historian, and his work with us and how much help he's given us over the years. And I said to David that day, we'll have you back on the show soon and we'll get a bit more detail about you. And that's what we're going to do here today. Because I think you've had quite a fascinating life, really, David. You know, just the more things you tell me, I think you probably see a more shocked look on my face. Because let's just start with, what did you study at university? What were you planning to do?
Yes, I'm certainly a classic example of a varied career path. I started after school, college. I went to university at Bristol. I studied zoology because I was inspired by the likes of David Attenborough to save the world, and went on to do postgraduate degrees. But whilst I was doing that, I was a Royal Marine Commando. I had a sort of second career.
And this was as a reservist?
Yeah, that's right. And I sort of loved the military life. So at the end of my PhD, I decided to join up full time, and I got a commission with the RAF Regiment, which is their elite infantry unit.
The RAF aren't just pilots and ground crew, they do have a regiment as well, don't they?
That's right. They're affectionately called Rock Apes. I don't know if I fit that category. But I got a commission, which was at RAF Cranwell, and joined in February 2000, so over 20 years ago.
So you've decided that you know, at one point you want to be a zoologist and you want to be David Attenborough. Then you want to go off and you've suddenly decided you want to be in the RAF regiment. But the things didn't kind of work out that way, did they?
No, they didn't. Unfortunately, 4 weeks into my commissioning course, I was driving home back to my parents' pad in Scarborough, North Yorkshire, and I had a car crash. Essentially, I was driving about 50, 60 miles an hour and lost control of my Jeep and hit a tree. And unfortunately, that broke my back. I spent 2.5 weeks in intensive care. I nearly died 3 times, so I'm very lucky to actually be here talking to you. But I spent the next year in hospital, pretty tough time, getting my life back on track and sort of reevaluating what I wanted to do with my life.
At the end of your year rehab, what happens then? Because obviously you've broken your back.
Yeah, so I made a bit of a mess of my back. So I'm permanently paralyzed now from the chest down. So I'm confined to a wheelchair. And I have been for 20 years now. It seems a lifetime ago. You know, it's a big sort of life change, but you do adapt. You know, like Sigint does, you adapt to your environment. And, you know, I've tried to fulfill an active life, pursue a really important career at GCHQ. But certainly, going back to my period in the 1990s, I'm a big patriot. So I love Britain. I love the country. And I'm very proud of my service. And I wanted to continue that. There's sort of an inherent thread there that I wanted to take forward. So I started applying for jobs down in places like in London, some of the government departments. But I had a friend who was a linguist at GCHQ in Cheltenham, which I knew very, very
well. And had they told you they worked there?
He did, yes. But I didn't know anything about it, but I put an application in. And fortunately, I was successful, and here I am. I didn't really know much about GCHQ when I joined. It's quite a strange sort of application process, and I'm sure
it's... Oh, I imagine it is, yeah. I don't imagine it's like something you just nip down the job centre to get...
I didn't really know what I was getting when I walked through the door, but it was fast. As soon as, you know, day one, week one, my first post was Oakley on the other side of Cheltenham, a base which has long since closed and been demolished, and it's now a housing estate in Sainsbury's. But, you know, it was just a huge eye-opener coming in on day one, week one, to seeing what actually happened behind the wire. And it really does make you think, as an outsider coming into this environment, into this secretive organisation, seeing the good work that we do to help shape government policy, help save lives, and keep our communications secure for government and industry. It's been a fascinating career. I wouldn't change it for the world.
No, I can see that. I think a lot of people would expect an organisation like GCHQ or any large organisation, if they have a historian, an in-house historian, that that person would have been brought in as a historian because, you know, that's their job. But it's slightly different with GCHQ, isn't it? Because we found this with Tony, because Tony had had a 20-plus year career in operations before becoming a historian, hadn't he? And your career, you worked in operations for how long?
Yeah, well, I joined in October 2002, and I spent most of my career in operations. And I think what it does is it gives you that really good grounding in how the SIGINT machine, the signals intelligence machine, works. It's complex. It's a difficult industry to get your head around. There's a huge technological aspect to how we go about our business in terms of providing access and to understand how telecommunications works and how our adversaries think. It's a challenge. So as a historian, it's actually really beneficial to have that grounding in operational work so you can actually understand where we've come from and where we are going.
And is GCHQ unique in doing that?
I don't think so. There's a number of historians in the Five Eyes community who have no background in history. They don't have undergraduate or postgraduate degrees, but they've come at it through working within that agency or department. There are examples, even within the UK intelligence community, of professional historians being recruited for that role. So there's pros and cons for both, really.
But like you say, I would guess, with it being SIGINT especially, that having that thorough background, even if you're just coming at it from, you know, your role, whatever it was in operations, you would have known a certain amount about your role and maybe, you know, the periphery of other parts where you interconnected with them. But that must give you a general knowledge of the whole organisation that someone from outside isn't going to get, are they?
No, they're not. You know, we work on secret intelligence. All the staff are vetted accordingly. And, you know, the knowledge that we accrue over a career in SIGINT is invaluable. And to apply that to our history, so you can understand and interpret what's gone on before in terms of analysis or technological development or access work, it's a real benefit to have that background and that knowledge to apply to, you know, writing the official history or providing a detail for, you know, social media or whatever it is.
So serving with GCHQ, did you see that as sort of your way of saying thank you for how you've been looked after your accident? Is that all part of this? Because from the very first time I met you, I could see the pride that you have in serving. And Tony did as well. And we see it in our veterans now. It's astonishing, really. It means a lot to you, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, it's a strange job to have, working on top secret stuff for the government or for the military, providing the service that we do to the country. But it is a genuine honour and a privilege to do it. And I view it as a different way of serving my country. I used to do it as a soldier, as a Royal Marine. And I just view what I'm doing now as a different way of serving my country and my country's interests. But I'm very passionate about what I do. And hopefully that will do justice to the job. You know, I'm huge, passionate interest in history generally. And our organisation, which has been in existence for over 100 years, is fascinating. You know, the breadth and depth of what we've done over that 100 years is fascinating. The Bletchley story in its own right is only 6 years of that 100 years. Mm. But Bletchley's story is absolutely exclusive. It's fascinating for the outsider, for the members of the public, which is why Bletchley has been such a wonderful museum. And to see it evolve since I first came here in the late 90s, it's been brilliant. You know, the work that's been done here to communicate the message of what was done behind the wire here during the Second World War, and the work of thousands of staff to prosecute intelligence against the Axis powers is just, you know, it's a really interesting story to convey to the public.
I don't know if we're letting a state secret out here, but my last visit to GCHQ, the pride in Bletchley Park is quite obvious because there's a certain Mr. Tiltman's desk in the main thoroughfare there, isn't there?
There is, yep. We're very proud of it too. So it's a particularly bespoke piece of furniture that we have on display. It was actually made during his time in the Far East. Beautiful hand-carved desk that stands in pride of place.
Over the years, I've got to know very few people at GCHQ, but I think there's kind of a pride in that you're all part of that same family from GC and CS, like Tiltman and Welshman and Tutt and Turing from World War II. It's like it's continuation, isn't it?
That's right. Certainly one of the things I've picked up as the historian is the enormous sense of pride that our staff have in certainly this Bletchley era. You know, the conversations I have with staff and the visitors we have to the museum in the Donut, you know, there's a real sort of tangible sense of pride in the mission that we do now, but yeah, also the legacy from the Second World War. SIGINT's not really changed. Technology has moved on, but
yeah,
signals intelligence, the process and
the fundamentals.
The fundamentals are exactly the same.
Well, I mean, this was why Welshman had problems in the 80s with his book, wasn't it? Because really what he was doing with traffic analysis hasn't really changed. Yeah. It's just the tools that are used to produce that now have changed.
That's right. And, you know, our organisation has always been at the forefront of technology. It has to be. We have to keep up with our adversaries, be that a state or a non-state actor. But certainly the cause for change has progressed at pace in certainly what I've seen in the last decade, last 15 years. You know, we're on a conveyor belt of change constantly in our organisation, but someone's flicked the switch because of the way technology is moving forward so quickly. We've got to advance at the same pace, and it's really transformed our organisation massively in the last few years. And it's really great to see it. You know, we've done lots of big transformational changes going back to 42 in Bletchley and the transformational changes that occurred then. We always have to change and adapt with our targets.
Yeah, and the threat. Yeah,
that's exactly what we do.
So in the ever-changing career of David Abrahtaap, what suddenly made you want to become the historian at GCHQ? Is that something you'd thought about? Or?
Over my life, I've always been interested in military history in particular. As I mentioned, I was in the military in the 1990s. And I just had a passion for it. And, you know, a big reader, love watching documentaries and all that sort of stuff. And over really the last 10 years, I've started to have probably a bit of a midlife crisis, but I've started to think about writing books, and I've published a couple of books. But it's really developed a passion in me about history. And I was working very closely with Tony on some of the books and made me realise I wanted his job. So I did. I applied for his job and I was absolutely gobsmacked when I got it, because I don't think I've ever wanted anything as much as I wanted Tony's job.
You know, I'm kind of making light of these strange career changes, but, you know, some of them forced on you, obviously. But was it the case? Was that your dream job?
It was, certainly. And, you know, I still pinch myself when I go down to our archives and, you know, and have to deal with the media and, you know, doing tours of the museum. It's just a fascinating, it's a very, very varied job, a very, very busy job, but it's fascinating. And over the 100 years of our history, you know, almost on a daily basis, I'm finding out things from reading archival documents or interviewing veterans.
Yeah.
It's just given me new windows on our organisation's history that I've never experienced before, and it's just fascinating beyond words. I haven't got the superlatives to use.
I have a very slight understanding of what you mean, because I can be here and find something in our archive, and that's something that, you know, is in public domain probably. And to me, that's literally like touching history, you know, and walking around these buildings can be like touching history. Mm. So to be in the GCHQ archive must just be, you know, that times 10, you know.
That's right. A couple of weeks ago, I was touching a piece of Foreign Office parchment, which is just a sort of instruction cipher piece of material that goes back to 1809. And I was just, you know, it does make you step back a while. And yesterday I was giving a tour of the museum to the Intelligence and Security Committee, talking to them about the Lorentz cipher machine, you know, which we've got on display the first time since the 1990s. It's one of the few in the world. And it's just the story around the Lorentz and what went on here in Bletchley to break that by Bill Tutte and John Tiltman. You know, to anyone, you know, the enormous sense of pride you have that they were part of your organisation that you belong to and that you work through. It's just, every day it gives me enormous sense of pride to walk through the gate, or wheel through the gate. And, you know, I'm the ninth historian in over 100 years. I stand on the shoulders of giants, you know, the likes of Nobby Clark, the likes of Frank Birch, who ran the naval section here in the Second World War, the likes of Tony Comer, OBE, my predecessor. We've got an enormous role and responsibility to tell our history. And in the last 10 years, you know, GCHQ has been actively promoting our history to a public audience. My role is a publicly avowed role, one of the few in our organisation. So it's my responsibility to try and convey through digital media, social media channels, through our website, through public talks and seminars and conferences, some of the work we do to try and educate the public and win public trust in we're not doing anything that's illegal or immoral. We are here for the good of the nation.
That is the difference. When I became involved with Bletchley Park nearly 10 years ago, we were leading up to the Alan Turing centenary and the, I'm doing rabbit ears here, historian from GCHQ would be here occasionally and he'd been involved with some of the Turing celebrations we organised. But he was just the GCHQ historian. And we've spoken about this before, how that role changed and Tony became Tony and then Tony Comer. And it has fundamentally changed, hasn't it, over those 10 years to how last November we could introduce you by your full name and, you know, we can now sit here and talk about your life. I think it speaks to how important GCHQ now see the role of historian. I mean, even in how you were handed over the job, Tony didn't leave on a Friday and chuck you the keys to the office, did he? I mean, it was a long handover, wasn't it?
Yeah, we were given 14-month handover. Obviously, it's been curtailed by the COVID lockdown from March this year, but it's a real dedication from the director and his team to commit to a proper and effective handover between Tony and myself. It's been massively useful because it's the, you know, the breadth and depth of the job is vast. To get an understanding of some of the processes and the work that Tony's been doing over the last few years was important.
Within the organisation, it is really a unique role, isn't it? Because you work for an organisation that is obviously secret, the staff are secret, but anyone can find out what your role is within GCHQ. Apart from the director, I'd imagine that's pretty unique, isn't it?
There are a handful of staff who are publicly avowed, so our name is known and our profiles are known in the public domain. You know, it's important that I have that aperture with the public so we can talk openly about history and for the public to get an appreciation of the work we do currently, but also in our history.
So you've ended up with this dream job then, David. What are your plans for it? I mean, are there topics or subjects that you want to work on or the organisation has asked you to work on? Have you got a hit list?
I've got a big hit list, yeah. Whether I've got time and bandwidth to do any of it is a question. Firstly, certainly in the near term, we've got our first ever authorised history coming out. It's been launched on the 20th of October this year. So Professor John Ferris, who's an academic from the University of Calgary, with the team at GCHQ, been working for the last 4 years to get this book written. And it's been published by Bloomsbury. And it's been an enormous undertaking. And we're really, really proud that it is actually coming out. It's going to be a global release. So certainly a really useful Christmas stocking filler.
And have you been directly involved with that?
Only in its latter stages. Yeah, Tony's been front and centre of it for the last 4 years with a team that's been working within the archives to get the classified documents. So certainly the background for that, there's going to be a lot of marketing publicity around that. Obviously a lot of promotional media work to be done in the next few weeks. But after that, we're going to have to release the classified files that have been used by Ferris for the book. So there's going to be a big program of public release on various topics, things like the Palestine mandate in the 1940s, the Indonesian confrontasi, etc.
Is that something that you that the historian gets directly involved with?
Yes.
With the releases?
Yep. So working with the National Archives, but you know, I'm keen that we actually host it on our website as well.
And does that actually involve going through boxes of paper?
Yes.
Yeah. And that must... I mean, there's a huge smile on your face at the moment. And is that special?
Yeah. I love it. Yeah, it's just fascinating. You open a box in the archives and, you know, you often... got some understanding of what might be in that box.
Yeah.
But you open it up. I'm sure that, you know, listeners who go down to the National Archives and go through files there understand where I'm coming from. You know, you, it's just like being in a sweet shop when you're a kid. It still gives me a buzz.
Because these things, you know, we expect everything now to look exactly the same. Paper's all A4, you know, or it's an email, you know. Mm. But we go back, you know, even 20 years, 30 years, you know, 100 years of GCHQ, you know, we've got all types of paper, all types of documents. It is exactly like that, isn't it? It's a sweet shop.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, some of the photographs we've seen, you know, just brilliant. It takes you back to those bygone eras and, you know, stations that have been and gone, you know, in our history. And it's just a snapshot in time, you know, of 100 years of history.
So once you've got over the initial furore of the official history coming out, what have you got lined up that you want to work on? What do you want to shine a light on?
The Authorised History will be coming out in October, but one of the big topics that I want to wrestle with is our official history. Now, our official history is our classified history, stuff that we keep as our corporate record. It's essentially a book written about a period of our time, and that's a huge amount of work, but it's one I'm really keen to do, and it'll be a privilege for me to write.
Yeah. Carrying out this work on your official history, you're basically following in the footsteps of people like Hugh Alexander and the section leaders who were here during World War II, because the last things that they did were the official histories of the Hutt. So you're part of that lineage now.
That's right, yeah, and it's an enormous responsibility. I feel a bit daunted.
There's a huge smile. I wish people could, for once in my life, I wish this wasn't through the medium of audio, because... as I said that to David, he didn't know I was going to say that. The smile on his face was just, that was amazing. You do have such a pride in serving, don't you?
I do, yeah. And as I said, it would be a privilege to write it, and I'll do it justice. You know, I couldn't be a prouder member of staff to have the job that I have. I genuinely, you know, because I'm essentially one of the public voices of our department, and it's a real privilege to have the position. And I will give it my all.
Oh, I know you will. You definitely will.
But also, we need to keep the public engagement going. Tony's done a great job with the media team in promoting our history over the last few years, and we're going to continue that. So there's all sorts of things around that. And we've got, you're probably aware, that the public exhibition at the Science Museum in London closed in February. That's getting relocated to the Museum of Science and Industry in Manchester. Which will be opening on the 24th of March next year. So there's going to be a big amount of activity around relocating the exhibition. It's been our most popular public exhibition and the most popular the Science Museum has ever run. I think we had over 200,000 visitors in the 6 months of the exhibition. And it's a way of portraying our history to a different audience.
Yeah.
And the Science Museum really catches a certain demographic.
Yeah.
And it's been a real privilege to display some of our objects from our collection that have never been on public display before, like the UCO 5 cipher machine, which is as big as a wardrobe. Mm-hmm. One of, I think, of only two in the world. You know, it's just brilliant to see these things on display so the public can engage with what we do in our work.
Well, I think I'll be taking a trip up to Manchester, because, believe it or not, I didn't actually get to go and visit it last time. But why Manchester?
Well, Manchester's... actually, the museum in Manchester is part of the Science Museum group, so it was always planned as the next phase of the exhibition, the top secret from ciphers to cyber security. Was to relocate it, and the COVID pandemics, you know, delayed things and make things a bit harder to coordinate. But that's been the next phase in the proposal. So we'll be launching there in March next year. But ironically, GCHQ has just opened a new office in Manchester, Heron House. Right in the centre of the city. It's interesting that Manchester footprint actually goes back to Bletchley days. If you recall, You know, Max Newman, who was involved with the development of the Colossus with Tommy Flowers.
After the war, yep. Newman...
He went up to the field and chair of mathematics up at the university, I think it was September 1945, and was instrumental with a group in the computing machine laboratory with Turing to develop the Manchester Baby, and the, you know, the first programmable computer ever built. So that there's actually tendrils back to Bletchley and to GCHQ's history going back to the 1940s. So Manchester's going to be a really exciting new phase of GCHQ's history. We've long been a world leader in pioneering new technology, but Manchester as a city gives us that ability to reach into academia and to industry in new ways and helping us pioneer a new kind of security. So Heron House, the new office, is going to be essentially a catalyst for this new approach that we're taking as an organisation to work much more closely with new businesses and institutions, things like the Cyber First campaign and others. And we're working very closely with industry to share expertise, but also to learn from them. So developing things like the CoLab, the GCHQ CoLab, and before that, the accelerator schemes, working closely with organisations like TalkTalk and Siemens to support a Salford University bid to create a new Institute of Technology. So the future's really quite exciting in the north for our organisation, and certainly a new demographic is going to be involved in reshaping how we have that footprint in the north with certainly a much more diverse demographic up there. So there's a launch of a new apprenticeship scheme for digital and tech solutions. I think 15 of our apprentices graduated on this scheme last year. So it's the dawn of a new era, Manchester, and it's really exciting that we've got the museum opening the exhibition next year as well. So a new, exciting period of our history.
It would be wonderful to have the ability of time travel to maybe bring someone like John Tiltman to now. And I don't think he would ever have imagined the organisation that he was part of would be so open as it is now, would he?
He wouldn't. It's right that we have transformed in that way to be much more open and having that dialogue with the public and increasing engagement with industry and academia. Yeah, we need to bring a level of trust and openness in the dialogue of our history, but also people need to understand what we do behind the wire. But Tiltman, you know, it'd be interesting to see what he would think when if he did jump back to, you know, this modern world.
Yeah, I'm not sure his tartan trues would have fitted in, to be perfectly honest. Now, this year we've obviously had 75th anniversaries towards the end of the war, and we've had 80th anniversaries towards the beginning of the war, and our It Happened Here episodes have been slightly curtailed by COVID, that we're going to have to pick these up as 81st anniversaries. But we've actually got a bunch of different anniversaries coming up over the next few years, haven't we?
We have, yeah, and that, certainly the biggest one looming is the 75th anniversary of the signing of Yakuza, the bilateral agreement with the Americans. You know, a sort of big part of that story is about Bletchley.
Because it goes back to Brusa, doesn't it?
Yeah,
the Brusa agreement signed during World War II, which really, I suppose, fundamentally goes back to those four members of the American intelligence community arriving here one wet, cold February night in 1941.
That's right. The Sinkov mission, you know, really laid the foundation of that new dawn in the bilateral approach to SIGINT. We should be celebrating it, but it's obviously going to be very difficult with the COVID pandemic across the world to, you know, celebrate it in the way we want to. So we're going to have to rely on technology to do that. But, you know, we need to celebrate the strongest intelligence partnership that the world has ever seen and put a marker in the sand for that. We've also got the 70th anniversary coming of the foundation of the Australian Signals Organisation, and also the Canadians' 75th anniversary as well. So we've got quite a few of the Five Eyes community anniversaries coming up.
I suppose, really, you've got the official renaming from GCNCS to GCHQ. Well, it's a bit fluid, that, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, GCHQ as a term was being used at Bletchley more or less as a cover
term. Well, it was on the gates, wasn't it?
Yeah. So, yeah, it wasn't officially adopted until Eastcote.
Which, again, the move to Eastcote next year is the 75th anniversary, isn't it?
Yeah. So we've got a lot of milestones.
I think we'll be having you on the programme a few more times next year. So just to finish off, and I know I keep coming back to pride and service, I was absolutely honoured to be invited a few weeks ago to Tony's retirement event. Let's go forward to And I hope it's a long and very distinguished career as the historian for you. Let's go forward to your retirement event. What would you love to be able to look back and say, I did that, I made that available to the public? You know, even if it's something internal, you know, something that, although maybe I'm asking this question, you won't be able to tell me that, but is there something that you'd love to say, you did that?
That's a good question, Mark. I've never really given that any thought, but it's essentially a relay race. You're picking up the baton and you're trying to go faster and harder than the guy before you. And, you know, Tony's done a fantastic job in his tenure as a historian, but I want to continue the work that he's done. I certainly just hope to achieve numerous things in my tenure. I'd like to, you know, write the official history, the next volume, which is a big undertaking. Continue the public engagement and doing the job justice.
You will do that in absolute spades. David, thank you for your time today. But more importantly, thank you for your service.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.